Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now, here's Carolyn.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It is Monday, January 23rd, and this is a live broadcast of the Heretics Hour. This is a two-hour program, even though it retains its original name, the Heretics Hour. Some people who are new to the program might be confused by that. Tonight's subject is propaganda war. We are in a war of emotion, not intellect, which is avoided by our enemies. So it's hard to know where debate comes in. Political debate is so often said to be what we need. We need to debate the issues. But does it really lead anywhere? I don't really think so, because the stage is set for one side to win, always. You know which side. But this side engages in constant propaganda to keep the common folk believing and on the emotional hook. And therefore, we need, I say, our own propaganda also. We need to think in terms of propaganda. And we need to think in terms of what what will move the emotions of people. There is no other way. That's coming up in the next segment. But right now, I'm going to read, as I have been doing, a couple of selections from The Fire, The Bombing of Germany, 1940-1945 by Jörg Friedrich. So I'm going to begin tonight on page 62. And what I'm going to read tonight is going to be about items leading up to when they finally came up with the idea that what they needed to do was to just bomb the German civilians. That was the only option they had that would really work, and that's when they went all out with that plan, that program. But starting here, Germany was the first country in which the fury of war from the sky was comprehensively and consistently taken to the point of devastation. Presumably, everything that happened would have happened anyway. The industrial age led to the bombing war, and Hitler was to blame for Germany's ruin. That is, that's how they presented it. You know, they still present it, that everything that happened, all the destruction, all the people who died, was all Hitler's fault. Of course, that's not true. But on the other hand, nothing happens anyway, and everything takes its form and its course. Inevitabilities are fictions. In the summer of 1940, many things played out fictitiously. What would happen if? The Luftwaffe wondered whether it would be better for them to reduce England's cities to rubble, and the RAF staff concluded that there was nothing else to do but use the only directly offensive weapon at their disposal to undermine the morale of a large part of the enemy people, shake their faith in the Nazi regime, and at the same time, with the very same bombs, dislocate the major part of their heavy industry and a good part of their oil production. That was a quote. Churchill informed his Minister of War Production, Lord Beaverbrook, as well as the ladies lunching with him, that there was only one way to fight Hitler. There was no Continental Army that could defeat the German military power, Churchill said, so if Hitler were to turn eastward, he could not be stopped. But there is one thing. You know, isn't that amazing? Churchill didn't want Hitler to turn eastward? I can't say, but there, here's another quote. There is one thing that will bring him back. This is Churchill. There is one thing that will bring him back and bring him down, and that is an absolutely devastating, exterminating attack by very heavy bombers from this country upon the Nazi homeland. Those were all figures of speech. Attacks that roughly corresponded to this plan were still 3 years away for England. In the spring of 1941, the Luftwaffe would kill another 18,000 British before turning its attention to Russia. Not that the British were at all lacking in bloody will, they simply lacked the means. Once Churchill took office on May 11, 1940, the British cabinet did away with the principle of protecting civilians. The first German city bombed was Mönchengladbach, where 35 Hampton and Whitley bombers dropped their loads on streets and railways on the night of May 11th. Four civilians died, including one British woman who lived there. As long as the campaign on the Western Front continued, supply lines and factories were targeted specifically, but there was an internal consensus that bombs could also fall within a certain target area. When six bombs fell on Munster on the night of May 15th, it was not a factory nor even the city itself that had been targeted. In response to the bombing of Rotterdam, the Rhine had been crossed. I hope I'm... Yes. The Rhine had been crossed. Flyers looked for 16 individual targets between Cologne and Dortmund, but ultimately dropped bombs wherever lights indicated a settled area. Because of the long approach, pilots preferred flying under cover of darkness. In order to avoid being waylaid, they chose individual routes and appeared in small numbers. Certain ground contours could be made out when there was a moon. If skies were cloudy, the pilots had to drop to lower altitudes. In either case, a point target could only be identified by circling, which took time. By then, a flak had spotted the bomber and begun to take aim. The sparse night fighter defense arduously came together. In contrast to England, arms industry locations in Germany were very spread out. They were difficult to find, but could be defended only if the defense forces were likewise spread out, thus thinning their density. Both weapon systems, offensive and defensive alike, were not in the least suited for a campaign that could decide the war. Bomber Command had fewer than 200 planes available for night operations. To assure that their bomb loads did not go to waste on open fields if they missed the targeted oil refineries, shipyards, and steelworks, the bombing missions concentrated on at least one urban objective starting in late 1940. Subsequently, on November 17th, 3 nights after Coventry, 60 of 130 planes reached Hamburg, started 6 fires, killed 2 people, and left 786 homeless. That was a big deal at that time. Only a 134-bomber expedition, the most extensive so far, bound for Mannheim, offered a sign of what was to come. This raid was flown on December 16, 1940, under the code name Operation Abigail Rachel. The city center had neither industrial nor military facilities of any interest. It was purely residential and therefore poorly protected and well-suited as an experimental area. Its characteristic grid-shaped structure also contributed to this, as it was relatively easy to recognize. It had streets that crossed at right angles and rectangular housing blocks surrounding square courtyards, which were practical for the study of the effects of explosive blast waves. Fire raising had not yet become a deliberate tactic. The objective was the city center. The orders were to raise it. The attack was opened by 8 Wellingtons flown by experienced personnel. They carried incendiary bombs exclusively. In contrast to later methods, these were used only for illumination purposes to mark the bombing areas for subsequent waves. Despite the cloudless night and full moon, the fires missed the center and were scattered in adjacent residential areas where 20 people died. The water main was hit early in the raid, but only a handful of fires were started, including one in the jewel of the city, the former Electoral Palace, the construction of which began in 1720 and was completed in 1760. Modeled after Versailles, it was the third largest castle in the country. Both interior and exterior were truly European masterpieces. I'm not going to go on with the description of that place and a little more there. I'm going to skip a little bit here and start again. Bomber Command declared two classic armaments targets in the first 6 months of 1941. Germany's oil supply and its shipyards. The Air Ministry put an end to the nightly flitting about for 4 or 5 hours in search of a bomb drop site. It named 9 cities where brown coal liquefaction took place, including Luna, Gelsenkirchen, and Magdeburg. According to reliable calculations made by the scientific staffs, the German war machine would come to a halt if 80% of the domestic production of synthetic oils were destroyed. On the night of February 14th, now we're in 1941. 44 Wellingtons set out for Gelsenkirchen to locate the Nordstern oil refinery. 35 found nothing. 9 thought they saw and hit something, but had no evidence. 2 planes were lost the following night in Sturkrade without having damaged the Ruhrchemie works. 40 planes bombed Hamburg. This is not Hamburg, but Hamburg with an O. Because the searchlights indicated the existence of factories, but the light was so blinding that it hampered the precision of the operation. The staff at Bomber Command concluded that point targets could be hit only on the 9 days per month when the moon offered enough light. The sky also had to be clear, but it usually clouded over, thus causing the oil offensive to fail. It did not make sense even to attempt to reach remote cities such as Magdeburg and Luna, so pilots got accustomed to flying over Dusseldorf or Cologne, since they were closest. Once a rural suburb went up in flames, another time 13 department stores and 2 Rhine steamers were hit. That was the end of the oil offensive, which gave way to the submarine offensive. British commerce on the North Atlantic suffered greatly in early 1941 due to German U-boat packs operating from Norwegian bases. It was as difficult to torpedo them underwater as it was to destroy their shipyards from the air, so Churchill ordered them to try both, in the hopes that at least something would be achieved. New cities were assigned to Bomber Command, including Hamburg, with an A, Kiel, and Bremen. On 2 consecutive March nights, they succeeded in wreaking havoc in the business and administrative offices of the Blohm and Voss shipyard in Hamburg. A lumber wharf and 2 docked submarines were also damaged. A second attack on March 14th took 51 lives, the highest number of casualties thus far. On the nights of April 7th and 8th, the 213 deaths in Kiel broke that record. For the first time in 11 months, Bomber Command could claim a victory. The first raid lasted 5 full hours, damaging the Germania shipyard. As a result, the night shift had to be sent home, and operations were shut down for several days. The second caused more comprehensive damage, spreading farther into the city center, where a bank, museum, and engineering college and gasworks were hit. Above all, 8,000 people became homeless, and residents fled the city and drove, many of them on foot. That came closer to Lord Trenchard's predictions. While Germany's raids on London did not have as profound a demoralizing effect, Trenchard saw a convincing reason for that. The steel nerves and humor of the British were not at all comparable with German self-pity. The Germans were virtually imprisoned in their shelters, wrote the aged Trenchard in May 1941 to Chief of Air Staff Sir Charles Portal. Quote, they remained passive and easy prey to hysteria and panic. There is no joking in the German shelters, as in ours, nor the bond which unites the public with the ARP, which is air raid precautions, and military services, unquote. This weak point, emphasized Trenchard, had to be hit time and time again. The oil and submarine operations had proved that war economy targets were vulnerable under favorable circumstances, under favorable conditions, But it turned out that the Germans could cope incredibly well with the industrial losses and continued to do so until mid-1944. Damages assumed immense proportions, but so did the ability of the enemy, that is the Germans, to balance them out. They had at their disposal the labor pool of Europe from Calais to Kiev. Contrary to the experience gathered from 1914 to 1918, that is, World War I, the war economy was by no means Germany's Achilles heel, But memories of 1918 also kept alive the recollections of mutiny and the collapse of the regime. On July 9, 1941, as the German Wehrmacht was marching through Russia for the third week, Bomber Command was given a third category of military objectives, the transportation system. The supply of war material that rolled eastward, especially from the Ruhr Basin, had to be blocked, and the Ruhr completely isolated. Didn't want to help them out with the war against the Soviet Union. That's my little comment. A chain of destruction was to paralyze Osnabrück, Hamm, Soest, Schwerte, Duisburg, Dusseldorf, and Cologne. Because of the short midsummer nights, night flights could only reach the nearby western German areas anyway, and during moonless nights, the urban regions along the Rhine, which could always be identified. The directive of July 9th, that's why the Rhine got hit so hard, so badly, because they were closer. The directive of July 9th, 1941, expanded the main effort of dislocating the transportation system with an additional clause, quote, destroying the morale of the civil population as a whole and of the industrial workers in particular, unquote. With that, the concept that gave the war in and of the air its form had been introduced in practice. It was morale bombing. Morale, if you will, is also made of air. The bomb was not aimed at physical people, but rather was used to attack their misguided way of thinking, their morale. The bomb is a social surgeon that extirpates unhealthy thinking. As soon as the patient begins expressing healthy views, he will be released from the doctor's care. Churchill pointedly described this occupation in April 1941. He said, there are less than 70 million malignant Huns, some of whom are curable and others killable. I'm going to skip just a couple of paragraphs here and continue. During the oil offensive from February to March 1941, the British lost 26 aircraft during their night raids. Between July and November, during the implementation of the transportation plan, however, they lost 414 along with their crews. That meant that at least every 8 months, Bomber Command's entire inventory had to be replaced. Losses can be endured only as long as they yield results, but Bomber Command was inflicting deeper wounds on itself than on the enemy. In August, an investigation, the Butt Report, was submitted to the government and parliament. On the basis of aerial photographs, the report concluded that under ideal weather conditions, merely one-third of the attacking planes hit their targets. The target was considered a region within a five-mile radius of the aiming point. In the Ruhr Basin, the main zone of operations, in poor weather, the hit rate was 10 to 15% of the time. That's not much. During moonless weeks, a hit was nothing but a matter of chance. The British bombers, the only weapon that could administer a blow to the enemy, had dulled to the point of uselessness. They could have been scrapped, but that would have left the British defenseless. That was out of the question. Consequently, all that remained was to try to reinterpret the devastating Butt Report in a constructive way. Perhaps the definition of target needed to be refined. If its target was declared to be whatever it could hit, then Bomber Command did in fact hit its mark. A five-mile radius was an unnecessarily limited area. A major city spreads out much farther. It is so big that it would be impossible, even with all available means, to hit every building and resident. In principle, a shipyard must be reduced to ashes or it will be repaired within 10 days at most. Such pinpoint accuracy is neither necessary nor desirable as regards a city. To decimate it would require such high expenditures, and since it is defended, would cause such losses as to make its total destruction impossible. However, one could and should destroy perhaps only a part, and the other part could draw its own conclusions from that. From what the British had at their disposal, according to the Trenchard Doctrine, the city was the stage for, quote, morale building, unquote. Esteemed as a thinker, Chief of Air Staff Portal presented his program to Churchill on September 25th, 1941. This program deviated from all previous ones. His objectives were no longer the hydrogenation plant, as they had been in February, or the railway lines, as they had been in July, but rather to attack that ultimate fuel that kept all of the rest moving. It was ubiquitous and therefore easy to hit wherever munitions were dropped on settled areas. They're talking about just the people, I think. The Air Force staff calculated that with 4,000 heavy bombers and a monthly load of 60,000 tons of bombs, tenfold the tonnage up to that point, 43 German cities with more than 100,000 inhabitants each could be destroyed. The civilian population of these cities totaled 15 million. Germany was to be forced to its knees within 6 months through the, quote, destruction of German economic life and morale, unquote. Churchill, who had repeatedly proposed an offensive of this magnitude, responded hesitatingly. He admired Portal and knew that the outlined path would be the one to be taken, but he was too old and had seen too many ideas, especially his own, that had been short of bets, fail abysmally to wager everything on hopes that this one would work. Using bombs to shatter the enemy's will to resist was shown to be just as difficult as using them to destroy production. The British, he wrote, were inspired and toughened by bombing, and at any rate, a war would not be won on the basis of one single method, and certainly not by playing with numbers. This current of skepticism appears throughout the entire bomber offensive. This was a weapon that delivered a blow like a club, but in the end missed its mark. The British continued to use it anyway, and even augmented its size and its capabilities, because it was better than doing nothing. Portal's demand for 4,000 bombers meant increasing the inventory fourfold. Churchill instead advised increasing the effectiveness of the current fleet and waiting for the United States to enter the war. He was not concerned with the specific reason why Americans would send off an expedition from their distant continent to destroy German cities. Any reason was fine with him. The Americans had already acquired the means a year earlier, and the weapon one most likely deploys is the weapon one has. Bomber Command, for example, kept a secret reserve of resources on hand, a reserve partly ready for use and partly almost ready, that was waiting for a strategic decision to be made. The decision was enforced by the depressing conclusions of the Butt Report. Bomber Command had bombers that could carry high tonnages quickly over long distances, radar navigation that could guide the bombers to cities, a variety of bombs that could cause damage over an extended area, and target indicator markers that illuminated a zone of concentrated annihilation in the dark. That type of marking had not been used in 1941, as bombing theory dictated that a point target must first be sighted. It did not matter whether it was the bomb, or even before that, the marker that was dropped. The marker outlined zones that a carpet of bombs filled with the materials of destruction. The bombardier, whether or not he aimed for a target, caused damage. He fired a shot basically like a cannon's, but vertically. It was all the same whether he fired blindly or aimed. The site where the cannonball hit was a target of some kind. Sometimes it was hit intentionally, sometimes unintentionally. The rules changed, however, when the pathfinders and bombers began to divide up the work. The grammar of shot and target became insignificant. The pathfinder no longer indicated a point, but rather outlined an area. It then was not a matter of hitting discrete objects within the area. Instead, the demarcated area comprised all that was simply not supposed to be and was removed from the world. Annihilation is the spatial extension of death. The victim does not die his death because he does not have one. He finds himself in a sphere in which life has ceased. Around the beginning of 1942, Bomber Command had not only the will but also the basic technology to create an annihilation zone. This zone was a sector of a city. An act of war was a process by which the sector was brought into a state of annihilation. This could succeed entirely, partially, or not at all. Like everything in a war, it depends on a number of factors and on fate. The former could be influenced. The latter happened. Bomber Command learned from experience as it moved from city to city. On the way from Lübeck to Hamburg, it acquired the ability to set the annihilation process going as far as could be calculated in advance. Between Hamburg and Darmstadt, it had to rely on favorable conditions for a burning apocalypse to develop. Between Darmstadt and Dresden, Bomber Command learned how to create the beacon of fire. Well, that's the part I had mapped out for tonight, and it worked out very well. We're coming up to our break, and when we return, I will continue with my program, Propaganda War. I have quite a bit of material to cover, but I still want to remind you that we have call-in in the second hour of the program, and the number is 1-855-477-2283. Usually I'm talking away and the music starts. It's always hard for me to tell exactly when it's going to come. But I can say, while I'm waiting for it, there it is. Okay, I didn't have to say too much. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I hope you will stay with me and return in about 5 minutes after this probably interesting news break, and we'll continue.
We'll be right back with more on The Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
EU nations have formally adopted an unprecedented set of sanctions against Tehran, which include a bloc-wide embargo on Iranian oil. The move targets Iran's nuclear program, which the Islamic Republic insists is for purely peaceful purposes. Let's get more details on the latest development now from our correspondent Tessa Arcidia, live in Brussels. Tessa, these fresh sanctions, exactly what measures do they involve?
Well, yes, they have formally and officially adopted these unprecedented sanctions on Iran. It's essentially a total oil embargo. It will have immediate effect on new contracts, but then existing contracts will be allowed to run for another 6 months. They've also agreed on a ban on gold and gold trade and other precious metals with the Iranian Central Bank. All of these, of course, aiming to financially and economically cripple Iran over its controversial nuclear program, with Western leaders still insisting Iran is trying to build nuclear weapons while Tehran denies this. Now, the EU embargo follows strict new U.S. sanctions that were passed into law by President Obama in January. So as far as the EU is concerned, by July, it will be a full and total implementation of these new sanctions.
Well, Tessa, when you talk about the implementation of these new sanctions and the idea of crippling the Iranian economy, surely blocking off Iranian oil to the entire EU bloc, it's not just going to hurt Iran, is it?
Well, certainly, this is unprecedented in terms of the scope and the desired potential effects on Iran, but it is also unprecedented in terms of its potential economic impact on the European Union itself. Let's not forget, the EU imports up to 20% of Iranian oil. It's the second biggest buyer. And among the 27, the biggest buyers within that are Italy, Spain, and Greece, the very same countries that are now struggling to deal with a sovereign debt crisis. Greece, in particular, heavily dependent on Iranian oil, with up to one-third of its total imports from Iran. Also, it's relying on Tehran for easier credit terms, so they will definitely have to find alternatives for these countries. These are what the leaders will have to talk about, how to cushion the potential economic impacts on several member states. Now, there's also the question on the effectiveness of these sanctions, because there is still China, which up to this point has not agreed on to go on board with the U.S. and EU-led sanctions on Iran. It is still the largest buyer of Iranian oil, and if the EU and the U.S. don't want it, possibly China will just step in and buy the oil that the others don't want. So there's a question of whether these will actually work. And of course, because of all the uncertainty, oil markets have already reacted, pushing oil prices up. And higher oil prices will just mean higher prices of goods. And it's also, of course, that escalating tension at the Strait of Hormuz. Iran has said it has every right to block the Strait of Hormuz, where 20% of the world's oil tankers pass through. And it will definitely impact global trade on that. Iran said, well, they will likely do it in retaliation for the sanctions. There are already U.S. carriers monitoring the issue there. there definitely possibility of escalating conflict.
Indeed, Tessa, it seems almost every day we see a movement in escalation between.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager, and I was just reading about the bombing war, and I've decided to title tonight's program or to try to build it around the idea of a propaganda war. Even though I want to go into the Wannsee Conference again, I'm kind of going into it from that perspective, though, because there are a few things last week that I didn't, that I felt I didn't cover sufficiently. I didn't really give it enough time. So I'm just going to, make some, I think I already said that the propaganda is generally considered to be an appeal to emotion rather than intellect, and that most people are moved more by emotion than intellect, and so we do need to use emotional appeals to reach them. I'm just going to go over some things that I know that you already know, but it's good to be reminded. I think three of the areas of that are used in the propaganda that's generally used against our cause, which is, in my mind, generally the racial cause, the racial beliefs in racial reality, is disinformation, which is, of course, here's an interesting definition of it. I thought this was kind of a different definition. The creation or deletion of information from public records in the purpose of making a false record of an event or of the actions of a person or organization, including outright forgery of photographs, motion pictures, broadcasts, and sound recordings, as well as printed documents. Forgery is done with the intent to deceive. Well, that's exactly what we're talking about with the Wannsee Protocol and the whole idea of what took place at that conference and so on. So that I found that fitting very well. There's lots of ways to talk about disinformation, but actual forgery of records and photographs, motion pictures, etc., sound recordings, all that's going to come up tonight. Then red herrings. You know, a red herring presenting data or issues that, while compelling and might get people's attention, are irrelevant to the argument at hand, and then claiming that it validates the argument. That's also a big part of what I'm going to be talking about tonight. And also repetition. Now, we all know this. These things, this propaganda of our enemy is repeated over and over and over again and in the media, in the educational systems, everywhere. And that's why it's successful. So sometimes this repetition is more subtle. It's like in the form, it says here, of a jingle or an image placed on nearly everything in the picture or scene. You know, things that you don't, that would be more like the, what we called about advertising, where they put in suggestive images that you don't really, you're not focusing your attention on that, but it's making its self felt in your consciousness. But anyway, to start out, I'm going to say that we're coming up, I noticed today, I was reminded, that we're coming up to another Holocaust Memorial Day, January 27th. Today's the 23rd, so on Friday, we're going to have that Holocaust Memorial Day, which will, and we'll be seeing more and more stories about that all this week until we reach that day. Now, who sponsors this day? This day was actually designated only in 2005. By the United Nations General Assembly by a resolution number 60/7 during the 42nd plenary session. It came after a special session was held earlier that year on the 24th of January 2005, during which that was when the United Nations General Assembly marked the 60th anniversary of the liberation of the Nazi concentration camps, it says, and the end of the Holocaust. Now, there's no anniversary for the camps, plural, but January 27th is the day that the Russian troops arrived at Auschwitz. And Auschwitz has been considered kind of the whole entire Holocaust to many people in the mass consciousness. It's all about Auschwitz. And so the day that Auschwitz was supposedly liberated is the day for this Holocaust anniversary. But it's less, Auschwitz is becoming less and less meaningful as more and more is being presented about it and exposed about it. But anyway, all this is all politics. It's all politics. And politics is propaganda. So now I also wanted to mention that I looked at some sites and there's something called Speak Up, you know, Holocaust Memorial Day. You know, at the bottom, that whole website is sponsored by the Holocaust Memorial Day Trust in London. They have a UK email address. They're copyrighted 2005-2012 Holocaust Memorial Day Trust, all rights reserved. You know, it's a registered charity, it says. So it's run by Jewish people, by Jews. Now, it's a registered charity. Of course, they have everything they have is a charity. They have charities coming out of their ears. That way they don't have to pay any taxes. And they have set up this called Holocaust Memorial Day Trust so they can promote Holocaust Memorial Day and call it a charity for however that works get more and more publicity. And that's what's behind things like that are behind so much of these constant articles we see in the media, which these organizations are pushing these newspaper editors to publish these articles, to have their journalists write it up. They're always getting pressure to do that, I'm quite sure. So anyway, I'm going to start here talking about, I'm going to get off this for a minute because there's a story that is a good example of propaganda, but I think it kind of backfired. But I like the story. It's from Spiegel, but it's the German Spiegel. And it ran on January 19th, and I had to go use a Google translated version, but it's the way the National Socialist Government promoted vitamin C. And, Heinrich Himmler was at the head of this, project. And it says a doctoral thesis from the University of Braunschweig, a historian who I guess is just writing his thesis. The story is about his thesis, and it says, the Nazis were convinced that the First World War was lost because the people were weakened by malnutrition. They didn't want this to happen a second time. So from 1940, it's true they were weakened by malnutrition because the Germany was blockaded and no food was getting in, and they were trying to starve the Germans to death, and they did starve a lot of them. So that's all true. Anyway, from 1940, the National Socialists distributed vitamin supplements to selected population groups, particularly to infants, children, mothers, hard workers, that is people working at hard jobs, and soldiers. The, quote, German labor front, unquote, organized the supply of vitamin C, especially to workers in the defense industry. Now, there were multiple vitamin actions in the schools for students, and under Heinrich Himmler, the SS organized its own research project on vitamin C at Dachau concentration camp. Now, you know, Dachau opened up in 1933. It was a model concentration camp, or what, I don't think it was called a concentration camp, but it may have been. But, you know, it was a model kind of a camp for any kind of prisoners that you'd have, a kind of an open-air prison. And Himmler had started a lot of agricultural projects there. And the prisoners worked in these in the fields and, you know, all this. And he wanted to grow lots of herbs, and he was very interested in health and improving and what you'd call early health food proponent. And so the questions were mainly at Dachau were mainly about how high the exact vitamin needs of a person are, and what foods have the highest amounts of the particular vitamin. Now, this is very advanced thinking, and the Germans, even today, they have an excellent record in being the ones who come up with a lot of discoveries of new elements in food or that are good for you or that can, you know, overcome certain diseases and so on. And they have a lot of interest in health foods and so on. But later they're going to, I'm going to give you something that's a little bit of a surprise. Anyway, the Reich Association for the Nation's Food had a slogan, "Housewives use the hip." I think that's real cute. That's because they wanted the housewives to use the rose hip. The rose hip, as probably some of you know, is one of the best sources of vitamin C. And so they told the women they should be collecting the fruit at every opportunity and make a sandwich spread out of it. Later on, buckthorn berries, walnuts, and pine needles were used as a source of vitamins. And the SS organized a project of extracting vitamin C from the gladioli bulb, which would go to the soldiers of the Waffen-SS. The Reich Health Office in 1942 gave credit to the food programs and agents for the health and performance of the German people, that it had not been diminished so far during the war, difficult war years. The armed forces calculated at the beginning of the Second World War a monthly demand of 1.5 tons of vitamin C for their soldiers. The men at the front were among others that received the so-called V drops, vitamin drops, which were given to strengthen its defenses. Now, though, the paper concludes, after saying all this about the National Socialist regime and their advanced kind of work with vitamins, it concludes that the need for supplementary vitamins was considered hocus-pocus by 80% of the doctors. And the Nazis were just the people to fall for such nonsense. They said the Nazis were just the people to fall for it. I added the nonsense. But, you know, doctors today still say that people don't need supplementary vitamins. So what do doctors know? They want people to be sick, basically. But that's another subject. So this I thought was interesting because in the sense that they're putting out, they did a story on this, a kind of a small story, and they didn't put it in their international section, just for the German people. But then they have to, and whether they even believe it or not, the person who did this thesis has to conclude in his paper that the need for these vitamins was hocus pocus and the Nazis were just wasting their time with it. Interesting. Now, I have a lot of interest on this Beata Jape detention ruling. There's a new story out. I just want to make a point here. The German Attorney General has said that due to their ongoing investigations, which they are conducting, and as I've said before, there are 500 German investigators working on this case to find these three people guilty and any others that they can tie in with it. And she has one underpaid attorney, what do you call that, court-appointed attorney on her side. Now, this German attorney general said that she is convinced that Beata Jape is guilty. Jape is called a co-founder of the terror cell. That's what they said. They've determined that she's a co-founder. And they may charge her with attempted murder for setting the apartment on fire, because a neighbor may have been on the other side of the house, which was some kind of a duplex, and therefore it could be interpreted as attempted murder. Now, this stuff is in the news, and these people are saying this. This is so irresponsible. They say they still haven't determined, you know, how many, this is months later, but they still haven't, well, not months, but a couple months. They still haven't determined whether that neighbor was on the other side of the house or not. That's what they're saying here. But, and if somebody was in the other side of the house, and if they can prove that, or if they can make it stick that she set fire to some portion of that house on the other side, that she can be tried for attempted murder, even though she didn't know the person was there. I wouldn't know anything about that. But they also believe that she was privy to the acts of the killers. Now, you know, the thing I want to say is about propaganda. They're going to throw the book at her, especially because she's a female. They want to discourage women from being right-wing, from associating with right-wing men, associating with right-wing groups. And they're using her, and they've been going after women for some time, making out. They just hate it. They just hate it when nice, ordinary-looking women are in these protest groups or are associated with the right wing or in the NPD or anything like that, because they want this skinhead image. They carefully nurture this skinhead image that all these are neo-Nazis, all right-wingers are neo-Nazis with tattoos and shaved heads, etc., and big boots. This poor woman, I really feel for her, because she was, in my estimation, she was no doubt functioning according to her deep-seated and true beliefs about what was good for Germany. And now she's, you know, they've already determined that they're going to find her guilty. If they hadn't already determined that, they wouldn't be saying these things. They wouldn't be able to say these things. You know, and even so, it's, she should be able to sue them for what they're doing, but she's in jail and can't do it. Now here's a story about John Demjanjuk, who is suing. This just came out. He was convicted, of course, you know, last year in his trial of being this guard, and therefore being guilty of the death of, you know, 28,000 people or something, even though he's not responsible for a single one. But he has now asked the German state for financial help to sue the country's biggest selling newspaper for alleged defamation. This is the Bild newspaper. And he says that it labeled him a war criminal and a Nazi henchman before he was convicted last May in that trial. And it's probably true. He probably has it that they have. And he has asked he's asked the German court system to give him the money to sue. That they have something there, obviously, that if you're that you can do that if you have been defamed or if you have a need, if you can show that you have a right, that you have something going on your side, they will give you the money to carry out your lawsuit. But this lower court granted him only 5,000 euros. Now that's not going to get him anywhere in a court case. And they said that, they said he could sue. No, here's the thing. He said he could sue for 5,000 in damages. And he couldn't reasonably expect to get any more than that. Now he's suing this huge newspaper, the biggest newspaper in Germany. And he can only, they're saying, we'll help you but you can only sue for a maximum of 5,000. Euros. But he's appealing that, saying he needs funding to sue for 25,000 euros. And the Bild maintains that its reporting didn't go beyond the permitted limits, according to the court. Well, that's something that's going to be interesting to watch, because in Germany, they really go beyond the limits, and they're doing it in this Zwickau case. That's why it's such a good example to look at. Now, I'm going to get to the main feature here. Boy, it takes me a long time, doesn't it? There's so many things to say. But I want to thank Christine Miller for being here last week and for clarifying what Johannes P. Ney dubs the big slip-up about the Wannsee Conference. I want to remind you that the forgers made a second copy of the one and only copy found. And so now there's two of them in existence. Because this doesn't make any sense, I had decided in my own mind that one was a copy of the other. But that's not the case. There's just one copy was found by this Kempner. And I will go into that again. But somehow there's two of them in existence. One is displayed at the Von See Museum, and the other one is in the archives of the German Foreign Office. Now, the second one was a retyping of the first, substituting the SS runes for the normal German double S alphabet symbol. So this really, to me, and many other differences between the two of them, proves forgery of both versions. Because if they had found, this whole thing is very hard to understand. If they had found a real copy of the Von See Protocol that had been sent to this Martin Luther in the German Foreign Office, and it was a legitimate, valid copy of the protocol, 30 of which were sent out, or 30 of which were made, and one was sent to all the 15 participants, supposedly. If they had his, even if it didn't have the SS runes, even if it had, it was typed with the German double S alphabet symbol, if it was authentic, they wouldn't make another one. But they did make another one. Somebody made another one, probably Kempner. They made another one to put the SS runes in there, and then they made other changes, and you can tell that they're not the same. So they're two different documents. So this throws the whole thing into a tailspin, really. And this is why Ney dubs it the big slip up. Now, I'm going to bring up some of these questions about the Von See conference again. Why it's propaganda, it's pure propaganda. There is obviously some truth somewhere, but it's been twisted around. This is what is called disinformation. It has been twisted around and with so many lies that you don't know, you know, what to make of it, where to find what actually did happen anymore. Now, the first thing I want to say is that everything about in the final solution, I mean, in the protocol itself, and in every paper, every article, everything that's written about it, they refer again and again to the final solution. Yet this term was not used by Germans. I think it may have been, it was used in some instances, but otherwise it was not used. They didn't call what they were doing the final solution. Yet every article is headed the final solution to the Jewish question. Now, Matonio, wrote a long article on this, and he talked about the term Endlosung, which means final solution. End, final, Losung, solution, which has been made a synonym for the extermination of the Jews. But in Goering's letter, which is supposedly the letter to Heydrich, which said I want you to create a solution. I want you to create a program to deal with the Jews, the Jewish question, and how to get the Jews out of our sphere. So he says, in Goering's letter, he wrote total solution, Gesamtlösung. Gesamt, I don't know how you pronounce it really, but something like that. Total solution. And it's generally they talked about total solution or a complete solution, not a final solution. And then he also said, I charge you to submit to me quickly a complete plan, Gesamtentwurf. He didn't do it very quickly, though, so you wonder about that. Now, an important document, some of this stuff I talked about last week, and let me say that if you're listening tonight and if you have not heard last week's program, I really suggest, or if you are listening to this in the archives tomorrow, the next day, whenever you're listening to this program, I would urge you to go into the archives and listen to last week's program, which was January 17th, I believe, and make sure you listen to that one. And then this one will make a little more sense. Now, a very important document. It's almost time for the break, but a very important document I want to bring up is August 21st, 1942 memorandum by Martin Luther of the Foreign Office. This is the one who got, whose copy was found by Kempner, the Jewish prosecutor at Nuremberg. And this was, of course, in August of 42, quite a few months after this so-called meeting. And he said that, he wrote a report of some kind, and he used the words that Goering had asked Heydrich to make all necessary preparations for a total solution. That's just another evidence that the word total solution was used and not final solution. Now, another thing here is that on January 27th, 1942, Hitler supposedly said, the Jews must leave Europe. The best thing is that they go to Russia. He said this during one of those after dinner talks. And this is one is recorded by Heinrich Heims. This is the authentic recordings of table talk, where there's some that are not very authentic. So this can probably be believed that Hitler said this not at some official public, you know.
We'll be right back with more on The Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. Iran says it won't change direction on its nuclear program despite new sanctions introduced by the European Union and the United States. Tehran described an EU ban on imports of Iranian oil as doomed to fail. It's one of the toughest diplomatic steps the European Union has ever taken, as FSN's Ollie Barrett reports from our London bureau.
EU governments will be expected to stop signing any new oil contracts with Iran, and all existing contracts will be phased out by the 1st of July. The EU currently buys around 20% of Iran's oil exports, so the move could significantly harm the country's oil revenues. But Russia says unilateral sanctions do not help matters, and has called for a resumption of talks on Iran's nuclear program, which Tehran insists is peaceful. The EU move came after a US aircraft carrier, a French warship and a British Royal Navy frigate passed through the Straits of Hormuz at the entrance to the Gulf without incident. Iran has threatened to block the trade route as tensions rise. Ollie Barrett, London.
The Obama administration welcomed the European Union sanctions and announced new measures of its own against Iran, focused on the country's banks. FSN's Daniel Wrenches has that end of the story from our Washington bureau.
The new US sanctions blacklist Iran's bank Tejerat and an affiliate, Trade Capital Bank, on the basis that they are providing services to other sanctioned entities the US believes are developing a nuclear weapons capability. The US is also welcoming the announcement by the European Union governments to an immediate ban on all new contracts to import, buy and transport Iranian crude oil. Both the US and the EU have previously imposed sanctions on Iran's central bank to try to pressure the country into cooperating with the international community over its nuclear programs, though Iran denies it's seeking to weaponize. Daniel Wrenches, Washington.
Italian officials say two more bodies have been pulled from the wreckage of the Costa Concordia cruise liner, bringing the number of confirmed dead to 15. The chief rescue coordinator said divers recovered the bodies of two women from the ship's lower decks, but they've not yet been able to access lower parts of the ship, and at least 17 passengers are still missing, possibly more. Italian officials in Giglio have also given the go-ahead for experts to begin pumping fuel from the cruise liner as early as Tuesday to avert a possible environmental catastrophe. FSN's Europe correspondent Vanessa Mock is there.
There's over 2,300 tons of heavy fuel and diesel. However, the coordinators here say they don't want that to happen just yet, because they say it might interfere with the rescue work, and also they are concerned that the boat is still moving too much.
From Bureaus Worldwide, this is FSN.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I am Carolyn Yeager, and I'm talking about, once again, the VANSI conference and the VANSI protocol, but in a little different way than I did last week. At least I hope so. I'm trying to. And I want to give out the call-in number, which is 1-855-477-2283. At this point, I just told you about what I considered point number one that I've got here, which is this constant referral to the final solution, which was not anything that the Germans were using or talking about. They were not calling it the final solution. Now, number two is that the notes of the meeting that they have, which is called the protocol, and which I'm back.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello. Okay. There was sound went out for a second there. This is Hadding in Florida. You said that they didn't use the term final solution. That's not exactly true. There was a letter that, I'm just hearing you now. Yeah. There's a letter that Heydrich sent on the 24th of June, 1941, 2 days after Operation Barbarossa started, to inform the Reich Foreign Ministry that...
Okay, I don't want to interrupt you, Hadding, but I did say that in some cases it was used, but it generally wasn't used.
But it contained the modifier territorial.
Yes, yes.
Eine territoriale Entlösung. So, I mean, that takes the edge off of it. It's not about killing all the Jews and having no more Jews if you're having to establish a territory, you know?
Yes, it was a territorial solution, and they often called it, you know, the territorial solution to the Jewish question, which had changed. I'm trying not to get too detailed here, but it had changed from being a program of emigration, and this has been talked about a lot, to deportation, because they couldn't, that wasn't working anymore due to the war and other reasons. So they then decided that they really needed to get all these Jews out of Germany. And I'm going to, let me just continue here, stay on the line, and let me just continue with what I want to say here, and then tell me what you think of this. Okay. As I said, that I don't think that this so-called protocol is damning at all. I think you're kind of agreeing with me, but in my opinion, and I know I'm not the average person, but I'm going to say this here. I think it's a good guide for us to follow when we have to remove large masses of people from this country, and also Canada, Australia, and Europe. We have to face facts of our survival, just as the National Socialist Germans were doing. Everything they did was in response to blatant and outspoken attacks on their very survival. Naturally, we'll be smeared in the same way they were, but that doesn't bother me. I can tell you, and I'm going to go into something a little different here, that my religious beliefs are simple. My religious beliefs, and I've kind of referred to this before, is that the real name for God is life. God is life, and everything that exists has the will to live. That is the only part of my religion that is universal. This life force is the most powerful force there is, and each creature and even every plant desires to live and continue to live and has that right. But the thing is, it's not up to one living thing to make sure that another living thing has the right to live. Everybody looks after their own right to live. That's why the will to live is so strong. So the Germans had the right to live and to remove from their living space that which threatened their future living. The idea that they didn't have that right was dreamed up by those who wanted to live off the Germans and suck their life from them, not only Jews, but also the British financial power structure and the Americans and the French, too. Mostly those are the ones. What's going on, Hattie? I hear some noises, strange noises.
I was just typing on my keyboard.
Yeah, well.
Okay.
Okay. And so, if we look at it, if we look at the notes of the meeting, and I'm going to read some of it. There's nothing except talking about why they need to get the Jews out of Germany. And you can argue with that, but I've just given my views on why I think they were perfectly, justified in doing so. And there's a lot of that can be gone into, like what the Jews had done, how the Jews were behaving, and now it was war, and the Jews were mostly sympathetic with the resistance and against the National Socialists. So they really couldn't keep these people. And why would the Germans see? There's this idea that the Germans always should have been just the slaves and the servants of all these other groups of people. And didn't have any right to stand up for their own, their own race, their own nation, etc., like other people did. So the minutes, I think, will show that that's all they were wanting to do. How do you react to that, Hattie?
I think National Socialism represented an attempt by German people to fulfill the meaning of nationalism and national self-determination. They wanted to be independent of the rest of the world and shape their own destiny. That's what economic self-sufficiency was about, and that's what unifying the people.
Be careful when you say they wanted to be independent from the rest of the world, because they didn't so much want to be independent from the rest of the world, but they didn't want to be sucked. They didn't want to be enslaved into that British Jewish financial debt system, which had been destroying them. That's what they didn't want.
Yeah, you can't really have self-determination, though, if you're dependent on somebody else. If you ever read Friedrich List, his whole economic philosophy focuses on the fact that a nation needs to be independent for its resources and so forth, because ultimately that dependence will destroy a nation at some point when they can't get the thing that they need.
You can try to be as independent as possible. It's pretty hard to be totally self-sufficient, and certainly was been difficult for Germany because they didn't have that many resources. So,
but you
can work things out so that you are mostly self-sufficient, and you can have the kind of defense, a proper defense for yourself, and your way to try to protect yourself, and so on, and bargaining chips, that's the way it all works. But the Germans didn't want to put walls up from the rest of the world and not have anything to do with the rest of the world.
That's true. But were working toward a sphere of influence, basically on the continent.
Mm-hmm.
and so that they could have their, you know, destiny and not be subject to other powers. And part of that would be to get foreign influence out of their country.
Now,
to the extent that it was detrimental, right?
Well, they didn't even mind some foreigners there. They didn't want foreigners to have the same rights as Germans for the most part. The German
citizens,
or
to control, control their
and of
culture.
Course, yeah, and it was mostly the Jews who they had in mind. And so, here's what they wanted. Here's what was on the program for this Wannsee conference. 1A, the expulsion of the Jews from every sphere of life of the German people. This is what they said they had done so far. They had so far been working for these objectives and carried them out, you know, pretty well. And the expulsion of the Jews from the living space of the German people. Now, a lot of people right here, they see this as just terrible. Now, right. If you look at this in realistic terms, why would it be terrible? If the Jews were doing damage to the German people in every sphere of life, and they were, according to the Germans, I'm saying we can look here as Americans heading, everywhere we look today, we see people talking, complaining, writing about how terrible this strong influence of Jews is, because it's everywhere, all over our media, you know, our motion pictures, our government, our law courts are, you know, everywhere the Jews are running things. And so why would we, but we're afraid to say this, why would we want to keep this up? We should get them out of, we should expel them from we should. And we need to be able to say this. And as you and I can say this, but there's very few who are a white nationalist who will say this. I think we need to start saying it.
I think people must have been much less sensitive about this question in the 1940s. Otherwise, they wouldn't have had to add all the embellishment with gas chambers and such. You know, they could have said, "Oh, how terrible! They wanted to expel the Jews and put them in a Jewish homeland. Well, that's so terrible." No, it wasn't. Apparently, it didn't seem that terrible to people at the time. You know, various other peoples had been expelled. The Turks expelled the Greeks and Armenians from Anatolia. The USSR scattered the Volga Germans all over the place.
That's a good point. Yeah, that's a real good point, Hadding. And of course, we've been brainwashed up till now, so much by all of this, using what they've invented as the Holocaust and things like the Wannsee Conference and so on, and the Final Solution and so on, that people think we can't start that. It will end up exterminating people, end up with genocide if we start that.
Well, yeah. You know, interesting thing about the Wannsee Protocol, it really doesn't say anything about killing Jews. I'm pretty sure it's a fake document. Dr. Fulverstone gives some reasons why it's fake. It doesn't have the proper seal on it and so forth. It's not on the right kind of stationery to be an official document, things like this. But it doesn't say anything about killing Jews, certainly not in gas chambers. It talks about some of them dying from hard labor building roads or something like that. And that's probably an embellishment.
That's what I think. I've been trying to think, considering that this document still doesn't say much, why would they create a forgery of it? Why, if they did find something, like maybe they found something, they found the real document, but they weren't satisfied with it. So maybe it had some things that were more kind in it, and then it also they may have added some of this stuff because it wasn't bad. It wasn't even as bad as this one. But they didn't want to change it altogether because they might not have known what they were doing, which they didn't anyway.
Well, we know that, you know, there were a lot of there were some different versions of the Holocaust story, you know, early on, you know, like they had the electric killing apparatus and, you know, brain bashing machines and stuff. And a lot of that stuff got discarded. And, you know, it could be that this Wannsee Protocol is based on a real document, but just kind of in a haphazard way touched up to look worse.
That's the only thing that makes any sense to me. because it shows all the signs of a forgery, and yet they don't say, oh, they were, you know, we're deciding on how to gas them or whatever. Of course, see, there's no way they could have come up with a good story on that, as you just said, because it was not clear at the time. If they had come up with a story then, it would probably really, we'd really be able to see that it was a forgery.
One of the important points, I think, is the fact that until Operation Barbarossa started, which was summer of 1941, the Germans had been working toward getting Jews to go to Madagascar. It was in the draft of the peace treaty with France that France should cede Madagascar to Germany, and that it would become a German protectorate and a Jewish homeland. And the reason why they had to give that up was that the British at some point invaded and took over Madagascar. Mm-hmm. I think actually this wasn't until the end of 1942, which would have been just before the alleged date of the Wannsee Conference. Right after USA came into the war, there was so much naval superiority on the Anglo-American side that they could invade and take over Madagascar, and that was no longer an option.
Okay, well, let me read here some things, some more points from this protocol, which will clear up some things we're saying. It says the most important task that needed to be done, according to what supposedly Heydrich was saying at the meeting, is A, to make all necessary arrangements for the preparation for an increased emigration of the Jews. 2, to direct the flow of emigration. Well, we're still talking about emigration, so maybe this is still from before. And C, to speed the procedure of emigration in each individual case. The aim of all this was to cleanse German living space of Jews in a legal manner. You see, they were trying to do it. They were trying to handle this Jewish problem in a manner which would be internationally legal. They wouldn't, you know, they wouldn't be accused of being criminals. And yeah, in a decent way, they're trying to do it decently. And this makes it plain here that they were doing that. And even later, they wanted to do it decently, but there were so many, and they had decided that they needed to just get them all out because of the war, I think. It says here there were approximately 360,000 Jews in Germany proper. This was in 1933. There are approximately 147,000 in Austria in 1939 when they first counted them up. And there are approximately 30,000 in protectorate of Bohemia and Moravia in 1939. So
that's about half a million.
That's a huge job. But they were either going to do it or try to do it, or they were going to just leave him there, you know. Number three here, another possible solution of the problem has now taken the place of emigration. This is in the protocol, i.e. the evacuation of the Jews to the east, provided that the Führer gives the appropriate approval in advance. Well, supposedly he had not given approval yet. They were discussing what might be done, or at least supposedly they were. That's what Heydrich was supposed to do, according to Goering. Now, these actions are, however, only to be considered provisional, but practical experience is already being collected, which is of the greatest importance in relation to the future total solution of the Jewish question. So approximately 11 million Jews will be involved. Let's see, this was the half a million you mentioned was just what was in the in these places. But
how many million did you say would be involved?
They say here in this protocol, approximately 11 million Jews will be involved in the total solution of the European Jewish question, distributed as follows among the individual countries.
Well, that's certainly never anywhere near that many came under German control during the war. I think they had about 4 million Jews under German jurisdiction at the beginning of Operation Barbarossa.
Yeah, they must be talking about like all the Jews in Russia,
yeah,
all the Jews in Eastern Europe. I don't know how.
I think there are only 18 million in the whole world, and
yeah, I think that's
a huge number. 11 million.
that shows that maybe there's something wrong with this document. But anyway, then it says Heydrich, I always call him Heydrich. Heydrich spoke for nearly an hour, supposedly. This is a summing up. Then followed about 30 minutes of questions and comments, followed by some less formal conversation. Luther from the Foreign Office urged caution in Scandinavia, and because Nordic countries, the public opinion was not hostile to small Jewish populations there, and they would react badly to any unpleasant scenes of, you know, deporting the Jews. Hoffman and Stuckart pointed out the legalistic and administrative difficulties over mixed marriages, arguing for a compulsory dissolution of marriages to prevent legal disputes, and for the wider use of sterilization as an alternative to deportation. Now, this was where certain Jews, not all of them, but certain ones, like ones who were married to Germans or ones who had other reasons, if they didn't want to be deported, they could agree to be sterilized instead. It wasn't compulsory. You know, it was that say, well, you could stay in Germany as long as you would get sterilized, therefore you wouldn't be having any more children. They didn't want any more Jewish blood getting into them.
That's for which people?
Well, certain ones. See, because they had all these categories of Jews. This is when they're talking about the the Mischlings and so on. And I want to make the point that this is absolutely necessary. If you're going to talk about deporting this whole group of people, and there's going to be a lot of exceptions, there's going to be a lot of people, you know, saying, oh, not this one or not that one. You have to have guidelines about how it's going to work. And everybody's not going to be treated exactly equal. So some people, like Jews who were married to Germans and they had children together, they were excluding those. They could stay, you know.
Yeah.
But these
some famous examples of it too.
Yeah, and if some of them were if they were still young, maybe those were the ones who would say, "Well, we would like you to sterilize yourself, so be sterilized so that you won't have any more children, but you can stay here with your family and not be bothered."
There were
Jews who had served in World War I. You know, they excluded those Jews who had done good things for Germany. And then they had the half Jew, quarter Jew, 1/8 Jew. That's all very important. You have to take that into consideration. I'm saying if we were to do anything like that, I wish we could, but you know, we would have to consider things like that. So this is not evil to be talking about these things. This is naturally what they would be discussing.
See, what that Rwanda Protocol alleges there goes beyond the Nuremberg laws, because under the Nuremberg laws, an eighth Jew is not a Jew at all. Not even a Mischling is an eighth Jew, right? They only considered half and quarter Jews.
Well, that may be what they were doing here, too.
The thing is, though, I tend to view it as casting doubt on the authenticity of it. That's one more reason to doubt it, because it's not consistent with laws that had already been made. Emil Maurice, Hitler's driver that had actually started the Schutzstaffel, I think, he was an eighth Jew.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
well,
he served in the Luftwaffe.
They always try to say that, oh, I'm thinking maybe of another one, his cook or something. Well, didn't Hitler have a cook in the early years? Or his cook, who was it, who was Jewish? I don't know full Jewish or what, but... you know, it's like when you get to know people. Some people you like them no matter what they are. And, you know, but if you're going to have a program, you've got to make a program and you've got to carry it out that way, you know. And so that's why they have all these, they have to work out all these little fine points. And another thing that they talked about was some of them said, particularly those who are dealing with labor, said you have to exempt Jews who are working in industries vital to the war effort and for whom no replacements are available. And Heydrich supposedly agreed to that, said, yes, those are not going to be evacuated.
They had so many Jews that didn't get evacuated. They, there were a lot of Jewish musicians, like Freddie Brockzieper, the jazz drummer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm sure there were some others too. You know.
Oh yeah, well there were. What do they say? There were 8,000 Jews in Berlin at the end of the war, something like that. So, this deportation of Jews was not a big success. I mean, they were carrying it out, but it never got really completed, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I think there were two different aspects to it. Somewhat less important aspect of it was that the Jews had a strange racial character that led to problems. For example, this guy, E.R. Jentsch, wrote a book called The Antitype, which is all about that, how the Jews are a source of trouble because of their particular racial composition. And you don't want that mingled in with your population in any great degree if you can avoid it, especially if they're going to be a cohesive population under themselves. And then the other way to look at it is to look at the Jews as a political problem. I mean, I think that was by far the bigger consideration, where you just don't want this nation within a nation that is trying to manipulate everything for its own sake at the expense of the people.
Exactly.
I think that was the bigger consideration.
And I think that's perfectly justified.
And for that, it doesn't make sense to worry too much about ace Jews. I mean, this is not like the one-drop rule
exactly.
in the United States.
Yes, exactly right. Well, we'll be right back.
We'll be right back with more on The Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
So we have another round of sanctions and an oil embargo in particular. What do you think will come from this?
It's an act of economic war, you know. I think nobody ever lost money betting on the foolishness of European Union politicals. In fact, it's another stake in the grave of Italy, Spain, and Greece. Top five markets of oil exports for Iran. Four are in Asia. The fifth is Italy. But Spain and Greece are also very important. So what are they going to do? People are going to set up a third country bank accounts or make payments through third banks. India, for instance, India pays for Iranian oil in a Turkish bank. This is something that the Spaniards, the Italians, and the Greeks could easily do. They will bypass because they need Iranian oil. Just like U.S. allies, Japan and South Korea, they ask for exemptions from the Obama administration. They will get it because they need. It's 10% of, in case of South Korea, 10% of the oil is imported from Iran. They cannot buy it from anybody else. And according to myth, Saudi Arabia has spare capacity to supply the markets. They don't. And on top of it, they don't want it because they need the money, high oil prices, to bribe their own populations against any Arab Spring movement in Saudi Arabia.
UN's nuclear watchdog has confirmed it's sending a team of experts into Iran later in January. Why do you think the EU rushed in with a drastic measure as a total oil embargo? Why not wait for the IAEA mission to see how that pans out first?
Well, it comes back to the foolishness. And in fact, don't forget that the country that proposed these sanctions at the European Union was France, led or misled by Nicolas Sarkozy, who's probably going to lose the next French elections. So the Europeans have an extraordinary capacity of shooting themselves in their feet. They keep complaining that they are hostages of Russia in terms of gas sales in Europe. And they are not hostage to Iran in terms of oil sales, but they need Iranian oil, especially the most vulnerable countries, in the Club Med countries, let's put it this way. If you talk to anybody in Brussels, that it's not replaying the official line all the time. Independent minds in Brussels, there are some of them, in fact. They say, look, we would go to Iran tomorrow, sit down with them, and do an overarching deal in terms of buying their oil and gas if we're not constrained by the U.S. sanctions. And now they are doing the same kind of sanctions proposed by the Obama administration only 2 weeks ago. So there, it makes no sense. They defend this as a dual-track approach. Sanctions, 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 and then we invite Tehran to talk. And Tehran...
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I am here with Hadding from Florida, who called in when in the last half hour, and we've been having a pretty good discussion here. Now I want to turn to the question of whether Heydrich was actually present in Berlin on that day. This is, I don't know how important this is, but it's kind of interesting that Wolf, there's certain things that he was responsible for in Prague that seems like it's strange that these very important things taking place in Prague that he had to attend to were going on at the same time that he was at this very important meeting in Wannsee. And so was he actually there at all? Now, Wolf, there's a book by Wolf Dieter Rotte that I read about by, I think this was from Wolf, Wilfred Heinck. I think he wrote this up somewhere. And it is... the book, The Final Solution of the Jewish Question, as well as Ivan Zantin, who worked with him. And it provides evidence which places Heydrich in Prague on both the evenings of January 19th and January 20th, because on January 19th, the negotiations for the reforming of the Czech government had been concluded and the government could be presented to the public, and he played a role in that. It was his personal draft that was the final proclamation, and he had reported to Berlin that everything was looking promising, and so on. And then the next evening on January 20th at 7 o'clock was the big reception for the new government, and he was there, and it's even in a. In a newspaper, the Deutschland im Kampf, Rotte found that in a January 1942 edition. At the time this was happening, it's a quote in a story, President Hache formed on January 20th, 1942, with the approval of Heydrich, a new government. At the reception in the castle, Heydrich stressed that this was not just a change of personnel, but a historically important change of directions. So he definitely was there. Now, did he leave there and rush to Berlin in the morning, say, and then they had this meeting at noon? But according to the information, the official story, he initiated this meeting. He sent out the invitations and so on. So, it could have been a scheduling thing that happened, you know, wasn't the way he planned it, but so he could have gotten there been there at noon, maybe left by 2 p.m., and gotten back to Prague. But there are a lot of strange things, like Robert Kempner, in a book he wrote about this, he's that prosecutor who found the protocol, supposedly. He wrote in this book that it was a snowy and slippery day, and people had to drive out to Vannesi with their car because it was too far, I guess, to walk and whatever. You know, it wasn't like right there in Berlin. It was out in the outskirts. And if it was snowy and slippery, how was the weather for Heydrich? All of these questions just come up, and it's not that cut and dried. So, and then another interesting thing is that Adolf Eichmann's testimony in Jerusalem. I've got that copied down here. I would kind of like to read some of it, but it's very, I don't know where I've got it.
Denier Budd's spin on that's kind of interesting. You know, Eichmann talks about bringing a submarine engine from the Baltic to convert two hovels into hermetically sealed gas chambers.
He said crazy things in Jerusalem. And, you know, I think they had him in solitary confinement. You know, they kidnapped him. And, you know, he probably had him strapped somewhere for quite a while before they got him to Israel. And, you know, such a traumatic event. And then he couldn't talk to anybody except these Israeli Jews and prosecutors. And so by the time he got it to his trial, he was just saying what he thought they wanted him to say, I think. And sometimes he said things that they didn't like. And there is one part in this testimony of his that is really funny, where they got very angry at him because he was saying he was talking kind of crazy. And I don't know where it is, though. I can't seem to find it.
I heard an interview with the Mossad kidnapper, Zvi Malkin, where he talked about when they got him, Eichmann, and he said that at one point after when they were holding Eichmann, he mentioned something about Eichmann's small son, and Eichmann was terrified when they mentioned his son. He had a little boy at the time, and mm-hmm. he was terrified that they were going to harm his little boy. So that's a motive to figure in.
Oh, yes, yes. Now here he's saying, his testimony in Jerusalem, he says, may I further point out, Your Honor, to complete the picture, that the second function which was bestowed upon me was the function of keeping minutes of the meeting together with the secretary. Now, there's a secretary there, and I suppose there's more than one. Now he says, this was not a verbatim report because certain colloquialisms were then couched by me in official language and certain official terms had to be introduced. Later on, it had been revised 3 or 4 times by Heydrich. It came back through official channels to us through the channel of Mueller. That's the head of the police organization, the Gestapo. And then again, we had to elaborate on it until its final form. Well, that's not so important, but it's kind of like he's bluffing by saying this was not really my work, you know, and it's not all that reliable. It's not really the way it was because they don't like it. It didn't say anything about killing, about extermination or anything like that. So, but this thing about the secretaries, let me find. Okay, he says, Eichmann, this is Eichmann. The stenographer was sitting next to me, and I was to see that everything would be taken down. Then she deciphered this, and then Heydrich gave me his instructions as to what should be included in the record and what should be excluded. So can you believe that if this was the kind of meeting they're talking about where this big final solution is decided by these high-level Nazis, that they're going to have a female stenographer taking the minutes, and then Eichmann, he tries to make himself out to be very unimportant. He was not allowed to say a word. He says, oh, not a syllable. I was not allowed to speak. I was just there doing, you know, keeping the records or something.
Yeah, that's totally weird. And they're going to have a crooked record of the meeting like the Nuremberg trial transcript.
Well, yeah, and then the judge and the prosecutor don't like what he's saying, and they say, and these were also recorded by the shorthand typist, and Eichmann says, yes, they were taken down. And the presiding judge says, and you were ordered by someone not to include it in the memorandum of the meeting, of the official protocol of this meeting, weren't you? That is, you know, you didn't write everything down. And Eichmann says, yes, that's how it was. The stenographer was sitting next to me, and did I already read that part? Yeah. And then he says, the question from the prosecutor says, did they discuss killing by poison gas? And Eichmann says, no, with gas, no. And the prosecutor, but how then? And Eichmann, it was a pause. This business with the engine, they spoke about this. They spoke about shooting, but not about gas. Later, the protocol goes on to say, and this is Eichmann talking about it, in the same passage that Gauleiter Meyer and Secretary of State Dr. Brewer, he wasn't the Secretary of State, he got the name wrong, believed and were of the opinion that certain preparations for implementation of the various... I lost my place. Oh, I just clicked it away. Anyway, then they get mad at him because he's not answering. Maybe the way he said when they were interviewing him or the way they want him to say it. Yeah, I've got it back again.
I found the number of Jews that were under German control at the beginning of Barbarossa, according to Heydrich's letter from June. Oh, that was June 1940. It says 3.25 million Jews. 3.25 million Jews under German jurisdiction at the beginning of Operation Barbarossa. So that's way short of 11 million.
Yes, I don't know where that 11, but that 11 million is in the protocol. Now, what happened to these participants? This is just a little thing I wanted to say, because I could go through all of them, but I won't. But, you know, they talk about all the time about how the Jews were murdered by the Germans, murdered, murdered, murdered. Every Jew that can't be accounted for, he's listed as murdered. But now of these participants in this conference, which was perfectly innocent, really, four and possibly five of them were murdered by the British. I say murdered because they either were put to death or they were killed by bombs, one of them. And one was killed by an Allied air raid. So that was either British or American. Two were killed by the Jews. One was killed by the Poles, two were suicides, and five were released. Now, quite a few of them, they couldn't find anything to do about that. Then the other thing I want to say is that Kempner, I don't know where I have that, Kempner didn't present this protocol that he found until the very end of the trial in 1948, the Wilhelmstrasse trial, or the ministry's trial. So that trial ended in 1948, and I read that right before it ended, that's when he presented this. And he found him in 1947. So what took him so long? And what were they supposed to prove?
You don't want to give the defense a chance to pick it apart.
Ah, that makes sense. Because that's the whole problem, is that these documents have so many problems with them, and they were not examined, you know, for authenticity. They were just accepted. So he may not have even used them for prosecuting these people, because he didn't want to have them examined that much. Well, the point of my program on talking about this is that this has all been built up. This is all their propaganda, full of emotional, references for all the people to take in about the terrible planning that these cold-blooded Nazis did in this fancy villa, you know, while they were eating. Another thing, they supposedly, somewhere it's written that they were eating a gourmet meal there and being served fine wines and talking about art and culture during their breaks. they didn't have any breaks. I mean, the whole this stuff that these people, this was some newspaper wrote this, the stuff that's presented is just total lies, just lies. Oh, yeah. And you can't do anything about it. I think, what do you think? How do we counter the kind of propaganda that we're up against? Because it people believe it.
It's very hard when you're dealing with Hollywood productions because people, you know, they feel that they've been there after they saw the movie, which may have been a complete lie.
Well, that's so why I think we need to speak more plainly. And even though people might start screaming and yelling, see, a lot of our people think, oh, you can't say these things because the people won't accept it. So you have to, you know, act like not even talk about this. Well, it's never going to go away that way. And nothing is going to be gained if this stuff doesn't go away. So I think we have to be more outspoken, as I'm being tonight.
Well, we've got to cultivate distrust of Hollywood, for one thing.
Yes, there you go. You know, unfortunately, people do love this stuff. Yeah. They love anything sensational and visual.
And develop our own film industry if we can.
Well, you know, that's what we need to get a lot more aggressive and get a lot more organized. And I think rather than running people for president, I don't see what good that does. I'm going to come right out with it tonight. You know, they have no chance. It's just a kind of a, I don't know who you're going to attract that way. I would rather, and then people are encouraged to send donations to the presidential candidates and so on, and spend money that way. Now, we're not using the available money in a way that's very productive for us, because we're not together in what should be done.
I think money spent on educating people and changing minds and attitudes is much more valuable than money spent on trying to win an election. Because down the road, if you can change people's outlook, that could lead to winning elections or some other political result. That's really laying the groundwork for political success.
Well, that's right. And then people have had plans to make movies. I thought Merlin Miller was going to make some movies, but now he's running for president.
And he's saying that he likes Ron Paul's positions. Well, okay.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I know we have to have a lot of talent. We just have to be, we're not on the same page. I don't like to always be negative and complaining about things, but a part of it is that we're not on the same page. And this enemy that is putting out all this propaganda, they are on the same page. How do they get on the same page so well?
Yeah, they don't have to be. I don't think they're all completely on the same page, because you think about the Zionist Jews versus the leftist Jews. There's a lot of built-in conflict there, but they've got so much money on their side that they can still, you know, it's, you know, we're the little midget, and there's these two giants that can't quite agree, you know. So it's not so much that they're monolithic. They've just got all the money on their side. And plus, our own people, you know, there are enough white people in this country. My God, if we all stuck together, there's nothing we couldn't do.
That's right. That's right.
That's
I think
our problem.
I really think we need to go stronger in about white, the white race, white folks, and so on. Stronger than we do, or just try to get more people. There's something. Some of this. Well, I'm not going to go into that. All right. I'd like to cover one last thing here about the Wannsee Conference. Himmler's one thing that they have on Yad Vashem on their Wannsee page is a supposed order by Himmler on July 19th, 1942. I have no reason to think it's not correct. They call it the completion of the final solution. But
which document is this?
This is an order by Himmler on July 19th, 1942. For the government general. It says in here, I herewith order that the resettlement of the entire Jewish population of the government general be carried out and completed by December 31st, 1942. Well, now, in January, Heydrich supposedly held this meeting, and then in July something else was done. But now in December, it's Himmler, and it really should be in Himmler's hands. I don't understand why Goering sent a letter to Heydrich, telling him what to do, instead of sending it to Himmler and let Himmler tell Heydrich. But anyway, then he says, from December 31st, 1942, no person of Jewish origin may remain within the government general unless they are in collection camps in Warsaw, Krakow, Częstochowa, Chowa, Radom, and Lublin. All other work on which Jewish labor is employed must be finished by that date, or in the event of this is not possible, must be transferred to one of the collection camps. And it says these measures are required with the view to the necessary ethnic division of races and people for the new order in Europe, and also in the interest of the security and cleanliness of the German Reich and its sphere of interest. Every breach of this regulation spells a danger to quiet and order in the entire German sphere of interest. A point of application for the resistance movement, that means should be like a point of activity or strength for the resistance movement, and a source of moral and physical pestilence. And so he says, for these reasons, a total cleansing is necessary and therefore to be carried out. And if there are any cases where this cannot be done, they should see me, and so I can take corrective action to see that, you know, what needs to be done. And that's all. Now, I don't find anything wrong with that either. I don't find anything terribly out of order in that. So I don't know whether it could be authentic or not. But so this makes me think that's what we're talking about as the solution. Is that, so we need a solution too, is that we need to point more than we have been doing, not in a crude way. We should never be crude. I don't like these people who do it crudely. We should point to the fact that the Jewish power structure in the United States is way overdone, way overboard, and this needs to be changed. And it needs to be changed by white people, for white people. And this, I think, would be the right way to go. The only way where something could actually, where you'd actually be pointing at the real problem and something could be done. But we have a lot of people who don't want to talk about Jews very much still.
Yeah, it's true. I'm looking at I think Warsaw was in the government general, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. See, that's kind of a problem there with that Himmler letter, because what was the date when he said he wanted all the Jews cleared up and gathered into camps?
By December 31st, 1942.
Oh, they didn't come anywhere near that deadline, because the Warsaw ghetto uprising was in April and May 43.
Well, but they were there in the ghetto, right? They were there in the, he said they had to be in these places, like in collection camps. That would be,
okay.
He said, unless they from December 31st, no person may remain unless they're in collection camps.
Well, see, I don't think the ghetto qualified as a collection camp, though.
Oh, I think so. I think
because
so.
Because they were clearing them out of there.
Well, they were putting
except
people
for a few
in there.
Elderly Jews, you know. I think they let the elderly ones stay, but they cleared them out and put them into camps.
Yeah, but there were a lot of people in those ghettos, and they had to be in those ghettos. So then they were maybe moving people out of those ghettos too,
yeah,
and taking them to places like Auschwitz where they could put them to work. And from Auschwitz, they sent them all around to different places. It was all about a work program, but that's confused. They confused all that with their extermination stories. But
yeah, see, Auschwitz is a lot farther east if they were, or west actually, if they were gathering people from Warsaw. I actually have a blog entry about this in relation to Norman Finkelstein, because he claimed that his parents were in the Warsaw ghetto uprising and that his father was then in Auschwitz, which is strange because nobody that was collected at the Warsaw Ghetto was sent to Auschwitz. They weren't, because it's nowhere near Auschwitz.
Well, I don't know. I don't know that. I don't know about that at all. But I do question Norman Finkelstein, because he has said that while his parents survived, and he says a lot of good things, but he's also said that most of his relatives perished in the gas chambers.
Yeah.
He said that in a speech that I saw on film. And I thought, well, good grief. I don't believe that. It's just like all the rest of them say that. All their relatives, yeah. But not them, or not the ones that they're now living with, but all the rest of them that you don't know who they are.
He says, I hate to play the Holocaust card, but then he plays it, and he does it all the time.
Yes.
I got my numbers about and destinations about where the Warsaw Ghetto Jews were sent from the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. So they're unimpeachable figures that none of them were sent to Auschwitz.
Hmm.
But he claims his father was sent from the Warsaw Ghetto to Auschwitz.
Well, there you go. So he's just making things up, too. Maybe.
Apparently.
Yeah, apparently. Well, we've got only part of a minute left. Hattie, I want to thank you for joining me. You added a lot, and otherwise I would have just gone on through a bunch of information, but I think this was better. So I appreciate it, and I want to thank the listeners for listening. We had a pretty good crowd tonight, and I will be back next week with something else. I have no idea yet what, but I know I'm done with the Von C. But beware, the rest of this week we're under the Holocaust Memorial Holiday, what is it called? The Holocaust,
Remembrance,
yes, coming up, and we're going to be inundated. So I want you all to look at all of this very critically and see how much nonsense is being thrown out there and that we're exposed to all the time.
I can't believe people aren't getting sick of this yet.
Maybe so. Thank you. Thank you, listeners. Thank you, Hattie. See you next week.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.